So welcome to the last lecture of this course. And today I'll stop drawing things on the blackboard. There is a more efficient way of showing pictures, which is just click on the keyboard and something comes out. So let me start with oh yeah, and I want to use this. So I thought if I say this for the third time, you know, some of you may get it. At least you'll remember the picture, right? So what we've seen these days, in this last week, is that we can, just by putting together a bunch of tensors into a tensor network, we can represent efficiently wave functions of many body systems. And of course, the key of doing that is that, the key point of doing that is that if we put these tensors together in a given way, we still can efficiently not only represent, but compute, manipulate with this tensor network, so we can extract observables. And another property that we discussed was that, well, this tensor network, just by the structure of the tensor network itself, by the way we've wired together all these tensors, tensor networks come with specific properties, right? We saw that the MPS had exponential decay of correlations, and that was just the result of multiplying together many times the transfer matrix. Number of times was proportional to the distance between the two points of the correlator. Whereas in the multiscale entanglement renormalization ANSETS or MERA, something similar happened, but the number of times we had to multiply some object was, some transfer matrix was logarithmic in L, right? We had a trip into scales back and forth, and that gives us difference between Lth power and log L power, and that was the difference between having exponential decay of correlations and polynomial decay of correlations. Another property we saw was that, well, we could upper bound the entropy, the entanglement entropy, and what we had in the MPS is that for any size L of region A, we could cut or break the wave function into two pieces, the tensor network into two pieces, one containing the physical indices for region A, and then the other part containing the rest of physical indices. And we could always do that by just cutting two indices, and that implied that the entanglement entropy saturated to a constant. Whereas if we try to do the same with the mirror, we realize that in order to split these physical indices from the rest of physical indices by cutting the tensor network, we had to cut a number of indices, the minimum number of indices we had to cut, scale logarithmically in the size L, okay? So that gives us this logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy. Okay, great, so this was 1D systems. We had, in 1D systems, we had that the MPS behaves as the ground state. Already just from the way we've put together tensors, we have behavior consistent with ground states of gap Hamiltonians. Whereas the MERA had a behavior, structural behavior, consistent with ground states of gapless systems. So what about larger dimensions? That's what one of the things we want to talk about today. Okay, yeah.
So going in 1D, how do you show that the MPS, using the MPS, you can represent any wave function in the Hilbert space? So where did, like, how does the loophole get exploited?
Okay, so there is no loophole. Remember that we discuss, given an arbitrary wave function on n sides, how to turn it into an MPS, but the Born index was taking exponentially many values. So that was a way of saying, let's make a sequence of singular value decompositions on a tensor. This is a procedure that is well defined for any tensor, and it gives rise to an exact representation of any tensor, or any wave function in this case. Now, as a variational ansatz, what the first thing we did was we limited the Born dimension. We said the Born index here, this Born index connecting every two tensors, will have at most, will take at most chi, we said chi values, and this chi is independent of the system size. So it's some number, 20, right? And so we can use an MPS in these two regimes. One is to exactly represent any wave function, and then the Born dimension is going to be exponentially large in the size of the system. Or in this other regime as a variational wave function, right, where we restrict, where it can only represent the subset of states, not any, not an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space, right? And then when we make this restriction where we say one dimension is fixed to chi values equal to 20, then it follows that it has this behavior for large system size. Yeah? Okay. So let's play similar game in higher dimensions. Now, if you want to represent a ground state in two dimensions, you may think, okay, let's follow, you know, let's try to generalize this idea. So I'm going to put together many tensors. I'm going to connect them in a two-dimensional geometry. I'm going to make the connections between tensors follow the underlying lattice, right? If I have a spin lattice, a lattice of spins in two dimensions, then maybe this is going to be a good answer for say the ground state of a local Hamiltonian on this lattice. And there are many things that we've been checking on tensor networks. We talked about efficient specification. Well, here it's a straightforward. It's an efficient specification. You have order n tensors again, where n is the number of sides, right? You attach one tensor to each side. So, and each tensor, if you assume that each tensor has finite size, then, you know, finite number of coefficients, then we have an efficient specification. It takes order n coefficients to specify a wave function for n spins. Now, we could also talk about efficient computation, and that would be much more complicated, and I'm going to skip it. I'm just going to mention that we cannot efficiently extract information. We cannot efficiently compute the scalar product of a PEPS. We cannot do that exactly, right? But we can approximately compute that. And approximately, you know, then how approximate that is, well, we could spend days talking about that, but we in practice, we just take this structure, we use it to represent wave functions, and we approximately compute, say, the norm or the expectation value of the energy, and then we don't mention whether this can be trusted or not. And that's a way of proceeding. But what I want to discuss instead is to look at, again, structural properties that follow just from the way we've connected the tensors into a tensor network. And what we will see is that we can have two types of behavior. We can have exponential decay again, or we could also have polynomial decay. This will depend on the content on the tensors, what the variational parameters we use inside the tensors. And then for the entropy, we'll see that it obeys the boundary law. And we could do the same for the mirror and just generalize the structure. And I'm not drawing this because it's very tough. And yeah. I haven't seen many drawings of 2D mirror in the market yet. But if we did that, we would see the efficiency, so we could, again, efficiently represent the wave function. We could actually also compute everything efficiently. There are no questions about that. And we would find generically polynomial decay of correlations, and the entropy would obey a boundary law, okay? So what we find is that the natural generalizations of the matrix product state, which is called projected entangled pair state, PEPS, and of the mirror, which is called mirror, would lead to the boundary law for entanglement entropy. And remember that in our classification of free fermions, we saw logarithmic corrections sometimes. Remember, if we had the Fermi surface of dimension one, then the ground state would have logarithmic corrections to the boundary law. So the natural generalizations that we have here will not be able to cover these logarithmic corrections. We'll have to think about other possibilities. But first, let's have a look at the projected entangled pair state. And to further motivate you to listen, I think the homework will be related to this. Then is the homework related to PEPS? Okay. Only one question. No, you shouldn't have said that. Lots of questions about. Okay, so let's have a look at a two-point correlator. Let's compute. Let's suppose that, you know, we have fill all these tensors with complex coefficients. I'm going to assume that in each tensor we put exactly the same complex coefficients as in the others to simplify, and we want to compute the expectation value of some operator sitting on sides x and y, and these are the operators O and O prime, and this is side x and this is side y. And what I have to do is I take the ket, the bra, these two operators, and put this together, into a single tensor network. And if I do that, I obtain something that I'm looking for above, from above, and it looks like this. So here, every circle actually is there are two tensors, one coming from the bra, one coming from the ket. Each index here is actually doubled, comes from the bra, from the ket, but I'm just simplifying things. We end up with a tensor network that looks like this, okay? And we would have to contract this, and as I said, we don't know how to do this exactly in an efficient way. The cost is exponential in L. But let's not worry about that. Now let's try to get an intuition of how the correlators will decay here, okay? And what I want to argue is that on the one hand, if most of the tensor, if this correlator is dominated by the multiplication of these tensors in between and the rest don't really contribute to this computation, then we have again an exponential decay of correlations, okay? Exponential in the sense that there is some transfer matrix again in the middle, then we have to multiply L times. There will be some largest eigenvalue that is being picked by this calculation to the Lth power, and that's exponential decay, exactly as in the matrix product state case. But that was assuming that all the other tensors were not contributing significantly to these correlations. If the other tensors happen to also contribute, then you can have, and we know specific examples where this happens, we can have also polynomial decay of correlation. Okay, we can build explicit examples of PEPs where the decay of correlations is polynomial, not exponential. Okay? Good. But let me mention that if we choose randomly, if we make a random choice of coefficients in the PEPs, we will be back to this situation. So this can be obtained through fine tuning, okay? But generically where we obtain exponential decay of correlations. Okay, let's have a look at the scaling of time and entropy, and this one really is very simple to argue. So what we want to see is remember that we can obtain an upper bound to the entanglement entropy by looking at how many bond indices we have to cut to split our region A, which is this square here, from the rest of the wave function. And in the PEPs, it's very clear that the number of indices you have to cut is proportional to the boundary of the region, okay? So automatically we get an upper bound which has the form of a boundary law, and then you can just test numerically and realize that generically you get this boundary law is saturated, right? So boundary law, no problem there. And now we could build this in three dimensions, four dimensions, and so on, and we will get the same. We would get the same conclusion. Okay, so we've seen that. We've seen, and I insist I will not draw this, but in the two-dimensional meta, the same intuitions that we discussed in 1D would give us generically a polynomial decay of correlations. Yeah. This projected entangled pair state is a way of understanding, it's a name that was proposed by the people who proposed this PEP, by Ignacio Sirac and Frank Verstraete. And the reason why they used this name is some intuitive way they had to construct these ansatz, which consisted in close analogy with the discussion we had on the second week, where we had this toy model for ground states with short correlations, which was made of nearest neighbor singlets. We had short entanglement, okay? So if you had that state, and now you go on its side and you apply some operator on it, then you get directly these PEPs. So it's not a projection. So strictly speaking, they call it projected, and what they mean is apply some operator, which by abuse of language, they could call it a projector. But it's not, it's not a projector.
Okay.
Yes.
Does it happen the same here for a 2D case?
You could. For instance, you could just say, okay, a particular example of a PEPs is the case where I take a one-dimensional path through all the sites, and I only keep that bond index to be non-trivial, and I make it trivial everywhere else. So imagine in the PEPs, I didn't say how large this bone index was. So in particular, it could be take one value, so I could remove it. And the same in this bone index and this bone index. And so I could just be left. In the peps, I could just be left with a bone index like this, right? And this is and then the tensors, and this is an MPS. Right? So this contains, in some sense, an MPS. And then we know that if the bone index is exponentially large in the MPS, we recover, we can represent any wave function. Okay. All right? Okay. So what I was saying then is that one of the things that we found is that the field of tensor networks is not so new. It's not so old. It's also not so new anymore, but we've been working on this for the last 10 years only, compared to other research or techniques, and this is relatively new. But progress to two dimensions has been slow, and in particular, we realized, well, we cannot reproduce the logarithmic correction that is shown even for free fermions, right? So systems of free fermions are considered to be this one of the simplest systems to analyze. And the tensor network program to simulating quantum many-body systems could not even get to free fermions in two dimensions. So that was a bit of an embarrassment. There were other reasons to be embarrassed, but this was maybe the most important. And so in very recent times, there was a proposal to overcome this embarrassment, which was to develop a tensor network that could reproduce logarithmic corrections. So this, of course, is interesting in two dimensions, but let me explain the main idea in one dimension only. Okay? And this is known as branching meta. So on the left-hand side, what we have is the meta. I want to convince you that this, you know, it looks weird, it looks slightly different from what we had seen before, but that's the same as a meta. So in the meta, we had two types of tensors. We have these entanglers, and then we had the isometries, okay? The isometries were taking two sides into one, okay? But what we have here instead, so we had these isometries taking two sides into one, but what we'll have here instead is the red or brown tensors are two legs into legs, so this will be a unitary transformation. But if you look at what happens to one of the outcomes, it's always into a fixed state zero, okay? So actually, if we fix the income, one of the indices in this unitary transformation, what we obtain is an isometry, okay? So on this side, we have just organized the whole meta in a way that it looks clearly as a quantum circuit that takes a 0, 0, 0, 0 state, a product state, into some entangled state, which we've argued that will have polynomial decay of correlations and logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy. Okay, so that's the left-hand side, okay? And on the right-hand side is this branching meta, where what you can see is that can be thought of completing this quantum circuit in the following way. In the meta, we take every second index and we continue to process it, and every second index goes into this direction, and we're done with it, okay? In the branching meta, we take every second index and we bring it to the left. Every second index, we bring it to the right. And we keep processing both of them, okay, through a quantum circuit. Now, this quantum circuit has been specially designed in such a way that we still have efficient calculation. We can efficiently compute local observables. So if you remember our quantum model, quantum circuit model, that we had this problem with the causal cone exploding. So there was no efficient, we could not efficiently compute. There was the cost of computing a local observable was exponential in the depth of the quantum circuit. Here we will not have this problem thanks to the branch structure that we have. I don't have time to explain that. I'm just saying this is one of the properties. Okay, so efficient computability was included in this design. But then, and let me mention also that this is the meta. This is the fully branched meta. And we can have many things in between. What I'm doing here is I'm trying to represent simply the branching pattern that we have in this quantum circuit. And the meta corresponds to just following one branch. Okay? The fully branched meta that we just discussed is the case where we follow all possible branches. So all possible branches are present and non-trivial in the circuit. And in between, you could choose to just have one branch at its length scale coming out. There are many possibilities that you could consider. Okay? And what these circuits have in common is that you can always efficiently compute expectation values. Okay? So it turns out that this is a way of obtaining entropies that go beyond what we were obtaining with the meta. So for the meta, we would obtain just in one dimension, a logarithmic scaling with the size of the block. Okay. If we increase the branching of in the branching meta, the branching pattern, for instance, with this particular branching pattern where we have several branches, we obtain log square. Okay, so it's more than the log. But if we consider the fully branched meta, then we can go all the way to, instead of having a boundary law, we recover the bulk law. Okay, so the states that we can obtain with the fully branched meta are still efficiently simulatable, so they are not generic in the Hilbert space. But as far as entanglement is concerned, they obey the same scaling that a generic state in the Hilbert space. Okay. This is all in 1D. Okay, and here these are just some numerical simulations that we did with. So the point of these numerical simulations is that whatever we argue about the entropy, which I will mention next, is just giving us an upper bound. You always want to go and check that this upper bound is saturated, and that's exactly what we found numerically. Okay, so why is this branching structure capable of giving you more entanglement entropy? So let's suppose we only have two branches, okay? Then in that case, when you try to detach some region, right? We want to take this wave function now and break it so that one part contains the physical indices of region R, the region A, and the rest of the wave function contains the rest of physical indices. When we try to do that, just a sec. Yeah. When we try to do that, what we realize is that we have to cut indices in both branches. Okay? And so more branches means more indices that we have to cut. And in this particular case, we would have, of course, logarithmic corrections. Well, I mean, a logarithmic contribution from one branch, a logarithmic contribution from the other. Of course, if we add them together, we just get log 2 times log L, which is still logarithmic. So this is not changing the scaling, but it's already making the point that in the presence of branches, there are more indices that we have, one indices that we have to cut in order to break the wave function into two pieces, okay? And so this is the intuition that with just one branch, we had this logarithmic correction in 1D, and we could go all the way by changing the branching pattern to a bulk law instead of a boundary law. Now, if we do the same in two or larger number of dimensions, what we find is that a single branch, so the normal meta, gives us a boundary law, okay? But then we can go all the way by putting more branches all the way back to a bulk law. And in between, we find the logarithmic corrections. There are particular branching patterns in two dimensions or any dimension larger than one that would give us the logarithmic correction. Okay. So this was just to give you an idea of research that is being done at the moment. Let's try to summarize the last 2 weeks. The first week, we learned that it was hard to simulate many body systems, and we learned some strategy out of this by using free fermions. So during the second week, we used free fermions to classify. If you remember, we classified all possible scalings of entanglement in ground states of free fermions. And we had in one dimension, we found for gap systems this saturation. And for gapless systems, we find logarithmic correction. And then in two dimensions and three dimensions, we had similar behavior. We had boundary law and logarithmic corrections to the boundary law. So this was the second week. And during the third week, what we've tried to do is to build tensor networks capable of reproducing all this scaling. And I spent a couple of days looking at MPS, which reproduces the scaling of the saturation of entanglement entropy for gap systems in 1D. We then spent a whole day talking about the mirror, and we saw that we could reproduce these logarithmic corrections. And today, I've just given you some ideas why we can claim that PEBS and MERA can cover all these cases, which are the ones where we have a boundary law. Now here, I told you that PEBS could reproduce also critical systems, which I'm putting only MERA in there. I'm just saying if we make a random choice of coefficients, of complex coefficients for the tensor, if we choose randomly these tensors, the PEBS is going to behave according as if we were describing the ground state of a gap system, whereas for this random choice, the meta will behave as if we were, were describing the ground state of a critical system. Okay?
I have a question with respect to the branching meta. So you showed that if I consider the whole branches, then my scaling law is as if it was for a system of one higher dimension.
Well, it's a bulk law, which happens to be, yes. No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that because the notion of locality, if you change the dimensionality, the notion of locality changes as well. So what we are describing here are states, which are where we have, say, when we say polynomial decay of correlations, we mean with respect to one dimension or two dimensions, a fixed dimension, right? So the branching mirror may display some type of correlation which is essentially local with respect to that dimension. If you now want to think of this state as living in an extra dimension, then you'll have to redefine it's not a straightforward step changing dimension. The notion of locality changes, right? Points that so we can always take, say, we did this, right? When we talked about using MPS for cylinders, we had a cylinder, and then we decided to regard it as a one-dimensional system. We saw that we had non-local couplings in one dimension, right? So changing dimension is much more complex than that.
So then, apart from just recovering the logarithm correction, why is the branching mirror useful if it doesn't reproduce the right scaling?
Well, no. Okay, so let me complete this by saying that indeed we can use the branching mirror with a given pattern of branching to obtain these logarithmic corrections, and that's what we wanted. This does not require changing the dimension of the system. In two dimensions, we can use a two-dimensional branching mirror to obtain states that we can efficiently process, and such that the entanglement scaling is L log L. There is no change of dimension. Yeah? Sorry, I couldn't hear. Can you use PEBS for what? Right. So yes. If you fine-tune the parameters, so as I explained, if by fine-tuning the parameters, PEBS can also reproduce the polynomial decay. Some PEBS are capable of reproducing polynomial decay of correlations. I could have written PEBS in here as well. It's just that it requires fine-tuning, and we don't understand. So we have examples where this is possible. We have specific PEBS that correspond to, that display polynomial decay of correlations. But we don't know if this is not the result of an optimization. It's a result of just thinking carefully, fixing the parameters carefully. And and it's not, so it's not clear that this is a robust result. But yeah, we could have written PEPs here as well. What I'm trying to do with this table, simple table, is to say that for a generic choice of tensor in your tensor network, you have a scaling of correlations that in the case of PEPs is exponential, and in the case of Mira is a power law. All right, so let's continue with this summary. Current applications of tensor networks. Well, I told you that the main reason to introduce tensor networks was to have some variational ansatz to study many-body systems. And what we can do nowadays is to use these tensor networks to study frustrated antiferromagnets in two dimensions or interacting fermions. These two problems are interesting because if you try to use Monte Carlo sampling, quantum Monte Carlo, we have generically a sign problem for frustrated antiferromagnets and interacting fermions, and tensor networks do not have this problem. So tensor networks have another problem, which is that there's a computational cost. Remember this, that the cost was order n times bond dimension to the third power for MPS. In two dimensions, it's bond dimension to the 12th power for a PEPS. Okay, it's a very large power. And so what this means in practice is that we can only have simulations for a small bond dimension. And this means that we can reproduce a boundary law. But this boundary law has a constant in front that is limited, right? So what we need to do is to improve this algorithm so that we can consider larger bond dimensions. And this is not an exponential problem anymore. So we are happy about that, right? But we need to keep improving these algorithms so that we can reach the bond dimensions that would be enough to represent a given ground state. And so that's where, for instance, that's what we need to improve in order to finally solve the Haber model. Okay? The fermionic Haber model in two dimensions. We can also study systems with topological order. Say the toric code, you've seen in other courses. So not just the fixed point wave function of the toric code, but now you take the Hamiltonian, you perturb it, you can use, say, PEPs to represent the ground state in that context where we don't have an exact description anymore. And we can also use, say, the Mira to study quantum criticality and phase transitions. Okay? That was the original motivation to introduce tensor networks. But in the meantime, it's been shown that you can use these tensor networks for other things, not just for numerical calculations. And in particular, we have nowadays a complete classification of gap phases of matter in 1D, thanks to the ability to represent those states with an MPS. And a lot of partial results also in two and three dimensions, okay? So tensor networks are a framework to classify phases of matter, to understand all the possible ways in which quantum many-body systems can be collectively organized. It's the one that you are an expert on. So the second group cohomology of the symmetry, so in the case of the presence of a symmetry in one dimension, we have symmetry protected phases, and this classification was derived assuming that you could represent all possible ground states of gap systems in one dimension by means of a matrix product state. And then by looking at different ways in which a matrix product state could be different states could be mapped from one matrix product state to another by looking at obstructions to this convertibility, the classification was possible. All right, and another line of research, current line of research involving tensor networks, have to do with the fact that we have a lattice realization, a non-perturbative lattice realization of a number of important ideas. The first one is the real space renormalization group. Okay, so I told you about this coherent transformation. That is the basis of a mirror. That is non-perturbative. It's in real space as opposed to momentum space, and we can apply it to, in principle, to any theory. Okay, in any theory, we can take a local Hamiltonian and try to cosgrain it and see what happens with that. See whether we flow towards some fixed point, and then we can study this fixed point. And other things we can do is as maybe closely related to that, is to use tensor networks to study conformal field theories on the lattice, okay? Or quantum field theories in general, and I'll mention also a continuum limit that is being taken at the moment. And then it was pointed out that these tensor networks, in particular the mirror, was a lattice realization of the holographic principle. There is also a lot of research being done in this direction. So let me, you know, let's use the last 25 minutes to discuss some of these ideas in a little bit of detail. But what I'm trying to do here is to illustrate that with tensor networks, you know, this is way beyond variational approaches. We can actually extract a lot of physics so we can think of this framework also as an analytical framework. And the first idea would be to use the mirror to characterize a conformal field theory. Okay, so let's try to connect the formalism of the mirror with the conformal data of a conformal field theory. Specifically, I want to describe how to extract all this conformal data. And so remember that yesterday we described some coarse gradient transformation. So now, coarse gradient transformation, assume that, you know, that there is a way of optimizing these tensors such that we've built this mirror by putting many layers of this together. We have an ansatz for a ground state. Imagine that using some procedure, we managed to optimize these tensors. Okay, so now I want to go beyond properties that follow from the structure of the tensor network. I want to go beyond that. I'm assuming that I have already optimized these tensors. Okay, so I want to go beyond saying that we have logarithmic scaling of entropy and polynomial decay of correlations. So if these tensors have been optimized, okay, given some Hamiltonian by energy minimization, then I can ask the following question. I can ask, given an operator, a local operator at this level, on this lattice, I can ask, well, what's the operator that I get up here in the coarse grain lattice, right? Remember that local operators were mapped into local operators. And in particular, I can ask, what operators are mapped into themselves under this coarse graining? Meaning, what operators, when I coarse grain them, become themselves times some eigenvalue. Okay? So the important point here is that this coarse gradient transformation defines a linear map between local operators, right? You give me a local operator, I can coarse grain it and get another local operator. So now this is a linear map, so I can diagonalize this linear map. I can find the operators, local operators, that are mapped into themselves times some eigenvalue. Using this, we can identify the scaling operators of the conformal field theory that this is representing, or the conformal field theory that describes the low energy physics of this lattice model. So what I'm saying is that through coarse graining, we want to identify operators that are mapped into themselves, right? And here we have a linear map, so we analyze this linear map, we can identify these operators together with their scaling dimension, which is just this delta that we have there, okay? And from there, we can extract all the critical exponents. If we identify the scaling operators of the theory, and we compute their scaling dimensions, but this is just diagonalizing some linear map and getting the eigenvalues, then we can extract all the critical exponents of the theory, okay? So for instance, for the quantumizing model, suppose that we use the mirror for the quantumizing model, then what we expect is, well, there is some structure in a CFT, there is a structure of scaling operators that are the primary fields, which are scaling operators, distinguished scaling operators, and then there are all the descendants of these primary fields. And the idea is that if we can characterize numerically the primary fields, then the rest follow from conformal invariants. So what primary fields do we have in the quantumizing model? Well, we have three. Local primary fields, the identity, the spin, and the energy, and the scaling dimensions are 0, 1, 8, and 1. Okay? So the question is whether we can extract them from the mirror, right? And actually, let me give you an example. Yes, these are the values. So or the identity of the spin and the energy, the scaling dimensions were 0, 1, 8, and 1. And these are the numerical values that you obtain from the meta. Okay? So you see that you get several digits of precision. In addition, so in here what I'm plotting is the scaling dimensions. In this direction we have 0, 1, 8, 1. For different scaling, for different primary fields, these are the three primary fields of the local primary fields of the IZ model, the identity, the sigma, and the epsilon, together with some descendants that we also obtain from the meta. Okay? So we didn't have to know that that was a CFT. We didn't have to know anything about this. We just take this linear map from local operators to local operators. We diagonalize it, and we obtain eigenvalues. And these eigenvalues, we take the log of them, and we obtain these scaling dimensions and for primary fields and for all the descendants. Okay? That structure was there. We just had to ask the right question. Similarly, it turns out that there are non-local primary fields, the disorder operator, and the two fermions, which also come out you can also extract from the meta, and together with their descendants. And if I plotted more scaling dimensions, then they would. These lines here denote the exact solution, and the crosses the numerical solution, the numerical result. And you see perfect agreement. If I plotted more scaling dimensions, then there would be disagreement. That's right. The starting point is you give me the Hamiltonian for the critical Ising model, and then I use the meta. I use a scale invariant version of the meta, so I consider an infinite system. There are infinitely tensors, but they are all copies of the same two tensors, one disentangler, one isometry. And then I have an efficient way of optimizing these tensors so that they minimize the expectation value of the energy. And these are the details that I'm just ignoring here. So I'm starting from the result of this optimization, and I'm arguing that we can extract all this information once we have this exact, once we have optimized these tensors. Okay? That's right. The variational parameters that are given by the coefficient inside these tensors. So I make a choice of this variational parameter size that I minimize the expectation value of the energy for, or the expectation value of the criticalizing model Hamiltonian. Okay? And everything can be done efficiently, as we discussed. So we can take the thermodynamic limit directly, do an infinite system. And then with the result, from the result, I can extract all this information by just looking at local at the map that relates local operators into local operators under coarse graining. Sorry? For these results, must have been on the order of 30. Nowadays, using a lot of tricks, one can go to almost 100, on the order of 100. I've never managed to do that, but some people have managed to do that. OK, so but you can see many digits of precision. There is no way you're going to mistake this with another CFT. But this is not all. We can actually also extract the OP, the operator product expansion coefficients, by just looking at how three fields fuse into one, into the identity. So what I mean is, again, from the optimized meta, we can extract more information. And in this case, it has to do with the fusion of primaries. And so what I'm saying is these are the exact results that that we know from CFT. And these are also the numerical results with corrections of 6 times 10 to the minus 4 on these values. So three digits of accuracy. And from there, you can build all the fusion rules. So these coefficients contain, as part of the information we have there, are the fusion rules for all the primaries, local and non-local. And then you can use that to identify a local and semi-local subalgebras within these primaries and so on. So you can extract, this is the conformal data of the CFT, okay? From here, I didn't mention how to compute the conformal spins. It's the only thing that, and the central charge. but it can also be done. Okay, so this was an example, okay, of how to use these techniques to completely characterize a CFT. And now let me also mention connection to holography. So it was proposed at some point that the mirror was actually a lattice realization of the holographic principle of ADS-CFT. And this is, again, a research area where it's an ongoing research area. So, but just to give you a flavor of what's going on there, well, it's simple, right? This was the space that we had. In this direction, what we have is the physical space. This is a one-dimensional system, so we have a one-dimensional array of physical indices. But we added scale to it, right? And I just take the same tensor network and I can plot it like this. Remember, well, I didn't insist on that, but these indices here are connected with the other side there. So there is periodic boundary conditions. And then if you take the central tensor and you put it in the middle, you can actually redraw the same thing in this way, the same tensor network in this way. And why is this important? Well, some of you know about ADS-CFT, and this is a duality between some of you know about ADS-CFT, right? All of you? Okay, all of you know about ADS-CFT. maybe I should say all of you, except for me, know about, yeah. Anyway, and this is, and what we have here then is a duality between a CFT in 1+1 dimension. So imagine that space is this, we have periodic boundary conditions here, so space is a circle, and then time goes in the vertical direction, right? And then this is dual to a theory of gravity in ADS in dimension 2+1. Okay, so in this case we have again the circle, which corresponded to space for the CFT, but we also have a scale. We can go inside the cylinder, except and time. Time is not going to be relevant in this discussion because we're discussing ground states, so nothing happens in time. We just get copies of the same thing. Okay, so now from this picture, just eliminate the time direction. We're left with just a circle, and here we fill it with a scale. Okay, so when we say CFT 1+1, we mean one space and one time. When we say ADS 2+1, we also have time here. And so what I'm saying is that this tensor network is actually spanning a second direction, which corresponds to scale. Okay, and you can start thinking that this tensor network also is describing a partition function in ADS. And actually, it's not just blah, blah, blah. So what you can do is you can ask questions about what's the distance between two points. And if we do it on the CFT, we have to count the distance, how many sides we have in this direction. Okay, so this point here is connected, is at a distance in the CFT. It's at a distance L from this point here, if that's the number of sides that we have. But when we look at ADS, the possibility of going through ADS, we realize that the distance, there are log L steps that you have to take within ADS to connect these two points. Okay, so what we conclude is that this is a lattice version of, it has the metric of ADS, that we have the distances correspond to ADS. Of course, it's a discrete version, so one has to be careful with this type of claims, but it's a lattice version of the metric of ADS here. Good. And then maybe another comment would be that the claim is that you can use the mirror to study ADS-CFT. But of course, in the mirror, we did not assume anything about the CFT. In the ADS-CFT correspondence, you typically want ADS to be a theory of gravity, and that is a non-trivial statement. You want some properties there. And this may require some properties on the CFT side. Whereas with the meta, we didn't demand anything. We have a generic CFT can be represented in this way. Okay, so you can think of we have ADS on ADS CFT, right? The holographic principle on one side. We have the meta on the other. The meta is a lattice version, so it's not really the continuum. But the meta is more general in the sense that we don't demand anything on the AVS part. Okay? Good. And another, are there questions? In the mirror, I start with the boundary theory. You give me a Hamiltonian, and the claim is that I can use the mirror to represent the ground state of this Hamiltonian. Okay. That's right. It's a discrete, so yeah, it looks like a discrete version of ADS metric.
You have to go backwards. So without assuming that boundary is a CFT, but then the, I would say, design the mirror such that the correlation function in the bulk would happen to be
well, it is already. For a generic choice of tensors, the how do we count here, what's the metric? What do we call the metric? We actually mean that we have a way of measuring distances between two points by looking at how many steps we have to take, discrete steps we have to take within this tensor network. Okay, that's the metric. Okay, and this is logarithmic. Oh, I'm sorry. You mean flat, right? You said flat. You mean as opposed to hyperbolic. Oh, I see. Sorry, I misunderstood you. No. I misunderstood you. What I meant is that this tensor network is homogeneous in the bulk. That all pieces of bulk, you are here, you are there. All the pieces of in the bulk look the same. You meant flat, as in zero curvature. That's what you meant. Okay. Yeah. No. I don't know how to do that. Okay, good. So another thing that is happening nowadays is that we're trying to take the continuum limit of tensor networks. Okay, and let me describe what this means in the play, in the setting where this has been accomplished already, which is in the case of matrix product states. So remember, for the ground state of a lattice system, what we use is a collection of tensors where we associate one tensor to each site on our lattice. Okay. So what we can do is we can represent this wave function by giving a tensor with three indices, I, alpha, and beta. I is the physical index. Alpha and beta are the bond indices. And a label n that tells me which lattice I'm talking, which site I am on. Okay. So this extra index here is labeling. This is not, these indices here are the three indices of this tensor. And on top of that, I use a label n to represent the site in the lattice. What you can do is actually take this label and replace it with a continuous variable. Okay? And what you want to do, sorry? No. Oh, alpha and beta, yes. They could, but it's enough for matrix product states. You can already represent accurately ground states if the bond indices remain finite and discrete and finite. So 20, chi equal to 20 will already give you a very good approximation to a ground state of a local Hamiltonian in the continuum. Okay. So what I'm saying is then this matrix here, right, may depend on, may change continuously. The coefficients, if you want, are functions of space now, okay? But you could also use this to describe a translation invariant system, in which case, remember that on the lattice, it meant that we could use the same tensor A everywhere. So then we could use also study the ground state of a quantum field theory where we have translation invariants. And in this case, this exercise of putting here a continuous label is, well, it was just to know that we went from the discrete to the continuum, but now we won't have any dependence. This will have a single matrix characterizing the vacuum of quantum field theory in one dimension. Okay, and there are some subtleties. This only works at least in a natural way when you have a finite density of particles, and there are a number of subtleties there. But this is one of the developments, one of the things that are happening that are very promising, because this is a non-perturbative approach to quantum field theory. Okay? And so other things that are happening is the equivalent with the meta. In this case, we could not deal with relativistic theories. We needed some finite density, and that was essential. I mean, it's not clear from what I'm explaining, but there was a catch, which is that we needed finite density. But if you want to study relativistic theory, then you can use the meta. You take the meta from the lattice to the continuum, and this has been accomplished as well, but only for free theories. Okay, so free theories, which we already know how to, you know, free fermions, which we already know how to deal with. As an exercise, you could consider generalizing the meta from the lattice to the continuum, and that's been done. And of course, the big challenge is whether we can do interacting theories as well. Okay? That would be, well, very interesting, because then we are really dealing with, we would have a non-perturbative approach to quantum field theories. Forget about Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory. And the same with PEPs. So in larger dimensions, in more than 1+1, a natural question is, can we take a PEPs into the continuum? And again, a lot of progress has been made, but so far at the level of defining things. Okay, it's a non-trivial step to understand how to go from the lattice to the continuum with a tensor network in more than one dimension. And so progress has been made. We already have a definition how to do that, but we still don't know how to turn this into a variational algorithm, so that given an action or given a Hamiltonian in the continuum, we could use this type of ansatz to find the wave function for the vacuum, for the ground state of the theory. All right? Great, so that's it. You know, 1 minute left if you have questions, but otherwise, we're done. To loop quantum gravity, no, but the quantum gravity group here at PI are using tensor networks they've been using tensor networks for the last year and a half. So I don't think that they use spin forms. They use more general structures, and they simplify the setting a little bit. They assume some regular distribution. But indeed, one of the things you can do is realize that these spin networks can be written as tensor networks, and then apply this type of ideas there. So this is being done.
So if in a discrete tensor network, like you, or a discrete NPS, you multiply together the adjacent matrices. Like, how do you think of the corresponding thing in a
That's right.
Where there is no adjacent.
So in the continuum, you still have left and right to a given point, right?
Yeah.
So you still have a way of ordering this continuous of matrices, this continuum of matrices. It's a path ordered thing. And then what you end up doing, its matrix actually is very close to the identity. So it's identity plus order epsilon corrections. And you regard this as the exponential of some generator. And then you end up doing a path integral on those. So the multiplying this matrix times this, times this, times this, is the same as multiplying the exponentials, I mean the exponential of their logarithms, right? And then this is the same as having an integral over all these generators. I can explain to you this in detail later on. Thank you.
Oh. Give her this remarkable shirt. This time it is of a different color.
It's different from last year, yeah?
Yeah, it's different from last year.
Actually, the one from last year looks like this after washing it many times.
So, and let me invite Gifra to teach this course again next year.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Thank you.